just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and chill.
People who make snowmen or ski are not the only ones who believe that snow is essential to life on Earth. Scientists do too. On today's Please Explain, we'll talk about the wonder of snow, from the physical structure of individual flakes to the important role that snow plays in the regulation of Earth's climate. And joining me now are David A. Robinson, the New Jersey State climatologist, professor of geography at Rutgers University, where he conducts research at the Global Snow Lab, and Kenneth Liebrecht, professor and chair of the Department of Physics at Caltech, author of several books about snowflakes, including Ken Liebrecht's Field Guide to Snowflakes. And I'm very pleased to welcome them to this show. Hello.
Hello.
And
Hello.
Let's begin with you, David. What's the scientific definition of snow? Is there any?
That's a real good question to stump me to begin with. it's a frozen precipitation in crystalline form is probably the simplest way to explain it.
Well, that sounds okay to me. I would have said crystalline water ice because that's what it said in a book that I read. How is it formed?
Well, it's formed actually from water vapor high in the atmosphere most often. You have a nuclei in which the ice begins to get deposited, and then it grows out into a crystalline form. And eventually gravity takes over and starts making its way down towards the surface of the Earth. Whether it makes it there or not is dependent on what the temperature profile is of the atmosphere on the way towards the surface.
So is it true that almost all precipitation begins in the clouds as snow?
As a matter of fact, yes.
Even in the summertime?
Even in the summertime at the higher elevations. Now, you can form some precipitation at low enough elevations, particularly during the warm season, that it would form by other processes, but the majority of the precipitation, and certainly all during the winter season in the middle and high latitudes, starts as snow.
Ken, we all know how beautiful snow crystals can be, and we've been told, whether it's true or not, we've been told that no two are ever alike, but I hadn't thought about the need for a field guide for snowflakes until now. Are there many different categories of snowflakes?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of different types, and if you go outside and look at them, you will simply find all sorts of different things, and it's great fun. It doesn't really require any equipment other than a little magnifying glass, and you can just have a great time going out and looking at the snowflakes that fall on your sleeve.
There are one type is needles. I don't know if I've ever seen needles, or have I seen them and not known that they were needles?
You've almost certainly seen them if you've seen snow. They're very common, and but you have to look. I mean, people just don't look. If stuff's falling right all over them, and they don't look at it. It tends to look a little like short bits of white hair on your sleeve. And if you get a magnifying glass, you can see structure. Sometimes there are hollow columns, sort of like drinking straws, except they're solid in the middle. And one of my favorites is capped columns. You can get crystals that start out growing as columns, and then they get plates forming on the ends of the columns.
Well, the ones we usually think of as being snowflakes looking like plates or fern-like things, usually with dendrites, are they just part of the total mix?
Well, sure. Sometimes the snowstorm will consist almost entirely of stellar dendrites or fern-like stellar dendrites, which have lots of branching and side branching. Sometimes the snowfall will be almost entirely needles, and a lot of times there's a mix.
So needles obviously wouldn't be symmetrical, and yet I've been told again and again that snowflakes are always symmetrical.
No, needles are symmetrical. You think of them as like wooden pencils. They're little hexagons, except they're columns instead of plates.
The Guinness Book of World Records says that there was a snowflake that was 25 inches wide and 8 inches thick in Montana in 1887. Now, that seems like a unique situation, but how can a snowflake get that large?
Well, that's not an individual snow crystal in the sense that it has the six-fold symmetry. What that is a puffball made of lots and lots of individual snow crystals stuck together.
Mm-hmm.
And you see those all the time when they're smaller, floating from the sky. And most people have seen them a quarter inch or half an inch. That's not at all unusual. But if there's no wind and the conditions are just so, they can get pretty big.
So they just connect to each other and they just attach in the way that they might attach when we make a snowball?
Much less dense. It's mm-hmm. really just like cotton balls.
David, snow, the amount of it and timing of it affects everything from the cycle of weather to agriculture to water supplies. Can you tell us a little bit about all of that? For example, snow affects weather or the cycles of weather?
Right. And when we're talking snow in this case, we're talking about snow that's already gotten onto the ground. A snowstorm is a beautiful thing and a dangerous thing, of course. But once the snow is on the ground, it can have all kinds of impacts. Speaking specifically about the weather, when you lay down a snow cover, the ground is much brighter, more reflective than it was previously. And that reflects a lot of the solar radiation back out into space, and it doesn't go to heating up the air near the surface of the earth. So we'll be cooler than we might normally be in the absence of snow. And sometimes that can create what we call a positive feedback, where the snow-covered ground cools it off, and therefore the next system through is more likely to be snow, and the snowpack will begin to grow, not only locally in depth, but will begin to spread geographically. And, you know, at a certain point, the brakes will be put on. Otherwise, the earth would become fully snow-covered, obviously. But it's that reflective characteristics of the snow and the fact that you need a lot of energy to melt that snow, energy that doesn't go to heating the atmosphere, that can have a profound influence on local temperatures. And it's also been shown that it can change the track of future storms. The storm track tends to follow the snow line, and as the snow line creeps south, in the winter, the storm track may creep south with it.
So snow begets more snow?
Yes.
How careful?
To a point.
Well, you said that the ground gets colder, and so the next right. time it snows, also the snow is more likely to stick because it has a cold surface to
right.
stick to.
Right, yeah. Eventually, believe it or not, eventually it can be self-defeating. Because once you cover the ground with snow, you get cold, dense air near the surface, and it builds aloft, and that clears the skies out. And with clear skies, it allows more sun in to do its work. And eventually that sun, it may have to take till you get the spring sun, but it will melt the snow, and off it goes in kind of the opposite feedback. So you build up the snow, you add more to it and add more to it, and eventually it can actually defeat itself by creating clear skies and allowing the sun to do its job.
Once it hits the ground, most of us would describe it as either powdery or wet. Powdery is obviously good for skiers, and snowball makers prefer the wet kind. Are those really just the two kinds of snow?
Oh, there's all kinds of snow. I mean, every way, shape, or form of snow you might want, from the slush to the extremely fine low-density powder. But as the snow sits on the ground, it immediately begins to start changing. It begins to compact, condense, and eventually, as we see up on ice sheets, it goes from what we call snow cover to fern, which is a denser ice structure, and then it eventually will become glacial ice if it sits there and gets compacted long enough. So immediately once it falls, it begins to undergo a metamorphosis.
My guests are David A. Robinson, the New Jersey State climatologist and professor of geography at Rutgers University, also the director of the Global Snow Lab, and Kenneth Liebrecht, professor and chairman of the Department of Physics at Caltech and author of several books about snowflakes, including Ken Liebrecht's Field Guide to Snowflakes. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Ken, it was mentioned earlier that at the center of a snowflake there's something that determines how it's going to form. How does that work? A little molecule of matter?
No, it's not that determines how it's going to form. It's the nucleus that gets it started.
Mm-hmm. So you need this thing that isn't water to get it started?
Well, what happens, so you got to sort of go back to the beginning. When you have warm, moist air and you cool it down, then the water vapor in the air will condense out. And on the ground, this would condense out as dew or frost on the grass. But in the atmosphere, it has to condense on something, and it condenses on dust. And so all the little droplets in a cloud are all nucleated by dust in the air. And as the cloud gets colder, some of those will freeze. And again, the dust in the center of the droplet will sort of get the freezing process started. And so it provides a nucleus. Now, once the ice starts to grow around the dust, then it sort of takes over. The dust doesn't really have any influence anymore on the subsequent growth. But the dust is sort of has its influence in getting the process started.
It sounds like what happens with a comet, which has some kind of a solid nucleus and then all this ice around it.
Yeah, there's some analogy there, I suppose.
What gives snow its the different colors? Is it that central nucleus?
How do the crystals have different shapes? That's because of the way the crystal grows. After it forms, and the growth is very sensitive to things like temperature and humidity. And so as a crystal is growing, if the temperature changes a little bit, the growth changes. And this is why you have so many different, no two snowflakes look alike, is because the growth is so sensitive to temperature and humidity that as the individual crystals are growing, they each see different temperatures and humidities, and so they all come out just a little bit different.
You're a physicist. How does being a physicist get you involved in snowflakes?
Well, I'm really interested in the physics of snowflakes, which is really just how they form. And I was rather surprised when I started reading about this that there's still things that we do not understand about the formation of snowflakes. We've talked about plates and columns, and the main difference between getting a plate and getting a column is the temperature at which the crystals grow. Some temperatures produce plates and others produce columns.
Really?
And we don't understand why that is.
David, you keep track of snow all over the world at the Rutgers Global Snow Lab. How is that done?
Primarily done by satellites. Different types of satellites, different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum are sensitive to picking up where snow may be sitting on the land or on sea ice or even on ice sheets. You can look at it with visible satellite imagery, but even microwave returns from the surface can indicate where or where not snow is present. So they tell you some information on where snow sits, the extent of snow cover, and there's some hope of getting a little bit of handle on just how much snow is sitting in any individual location by looking at these microwave returns.
Who uses the data?
Oh, the National Weather Service, to begin with, forecast models. We're not talking long-range forecast models, although they are interested as well, but just your day-to-day weather forecast.
It's a big deal in California, too. That's where our water supply comes from.
Exactly. That's constantly being monitored. They're essentially nature's reservoirs in many mountainous areas of the globe, be it the western United States or up in the Himalayas as it feeds the rivers to India and China and Bangladesh, for instance. A lot of the water in those rivers starts and is retained in the snowpack, later to melt as the summer progresses, for instance, and feed the rivers.
So when we hear that the snowpack on the top of many mountains, like Mount Kilimanjaro, is a lot less than it has been in the past, that tells us something about the water supply in the area below?
Certainly the potential of the supply. Kilimanjaro has never relied heavily on the melt of the glaciers from there, but it's interesting for many other reasons, particularly as we look at climate change and some of the discussion of that. But, it's very important. There's constant monitoring, not just with satellites for instance, in the western half of North America. There are sensors, essentially pillows, snow pillows, situated throughout the mountainous west, and they measure the pressure on them from the overlying snow. They take that information and send it up via signals that bounce off of asteroid clouds and dust and come back to a receiving station, and you get an idea of the water equivalent of the snow throughout areas of the western mountains.
Now, I'm assuming that it's snowing somewhere near the North Pole, but are there other places where it's likely to be falling at this very minute?
Oh, anywhere in the middle to high latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere right now, and of course down on the Antarctic continent, it could fall at any time of the year.
Even during the summer, because it's the summer down there, isn't it?
Yeah, but once you're out on the ice sheet, that the snow on that ice sheet never melts. It does, not a lot falls, by the way. It's really a desert-like environment. But what falls does not melt. It may sublimate away, which means it goes from solid to gaseous state, or in some areas it may blow away and drift elsewhere. But there's always snow falling, as little as it might be, over the Antarctic ice sheet.
Although the ice sheet is melting, we have seen in Al Gore's film and in other documentaries. Does that mean that we're seeing less snow in those areas?
No, the process is a little bit differently related. In fact, there's some belief that with a warming globe, some of those more polar regions may see more snow because there's going to be more moisture in the atmosphere in those areas, and it will still be cold enough to snow. So it's a real tricky situation when you're looking at these areas in the polar regions and trying to determine whether more snow is falling and or less, and what kind of story that's telling you climatically.
Ken, you said that there are still some unanswered questions about snow that you would like to know the answers to. What are some of the more significant ones?
Well, I'm interested in the physics of this, and just how the molecules hook together at what rates they do is what I'm working on, and trying to understand how that works. And the shapes of the crystals that you see depends in a very detailed way on what's going on at the molecular level. And so that's what makes these structures so enigmatic, because we don't really understand how that process works very well. It's kind of a material science aspect of it. Very interesting.
Can we extend what we learn about it to other areas?
Yeah, I sort of like to think of the snowflake as sort of like the fruit fly of material science in some ways, of crystal growth. Biologists study fruit flies, not because you're trying to cure diseases in fruit flies, but you want to learn things about genetics. And my hope is by studying snowflakes, which are easy to grow and easy to analyze, you sort of learn things about crystal growth in general, which you could apply then to other areas.
I'm sure our listeners have all sorts of questions, and we're going to take a short break and then come back with listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And my guests are Kenneth Liebrecht, professor and chairman of the Department of Physics at Caltech, author of a number of books, including Ken Liebrecht's Field Guide to Snowflakes, and David A. Robinson, the New Jersey State climatologist and a professor of geography at Rutgers University and the director of the Global Snow Lab. Again, 212-433-9692.
And Father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace.
So really I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't hurry.
Well, maybe just a half a drink
put
more.
Put some records on while I...
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought some corn for popping. Lights are turned down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
We're talking about snow on today's Please Explain with physicist Kenneth Liebrecht of Caltech and with climatologist, professor of geography, David A. Robinson of Rutgers University. And our number here is 212-433-9692. Our first caller is Bakan from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's your question, Dakan?
My question is it true or is it a myth that the Inuit have over 50 words for snow, as people often think? It's not exactly a scientific question, but I just want to know if anyone knows that for sure.
Do either of you know that, David?
Actually, I believe that to be the case simply because of all the different types of snow that the professor was talking about, all the, and my mention of how snow, the metamorphosis that snow undergoes as it once it hits the ground. So it does come in and stay in many different forms, and I'm sure people that live with it 9 months a year can come up with many different ways of describing it.
It's not just the Inuit. Skiers have many words for snow as well.
And city dwellers, too. There's snert, for example, and slush. We have all sorts of negative thoughts about snow. I have a friend who says the snow looks great for about an hour, and then it turns into slush, and it looks lousy for a week or two.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you for calling us. We go now to John from New Jersey. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, London. Question has a rather mundane one, but what was the most effective product used to melt snow when it hits the sidewalk?
Ooh, that's beyond.
Well, a lot of people put salt down. I guess that's the most effective in some ways, although dog owners hate the idea of that salt being out there because it does burn the paws of their pets.
Yeah, there's salt.
It does a number to your car, too.
It does a number on your car. Yeah, right. Corrodes the inside of the body, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It can. There's salt. There's different types of chemicals that are applied these days, some of which more corrosive than others. And it varies upon the temperature of the road surface as to how the municipalities treat the roads. There's even many places where the roads are pre-treated now before a snow event occurs because it helps keep the snow and ice from binding to the road surface. Therefore, it's easier to remove. So there's all kinds of fascinating field of study and technology when it comes to snow removal.
If we had some heat mechanism in the road, then we wouldn't. The snow would just melt and turn to water, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you can do sidewalks like that. It's very expensive.
What is artificial snow? Is that it? Does it look exactly like regular snow?
No, not at all. It looks like little frozen sleet droplets. The way you make that is you shoot water droplets out of a nozzle, usually mixed with compressed air, which expands and cools, and then the water droplets freeze when they're in the expanding air, and then the big fan blows them over the ski slope.
So
and here in Hollywood, you can get people who will, instead of compressed air, they'll use liquid nitrogen, and so we can even make it snow in Pasadena.
But I assume that if you put a magnifying glass in front of it, you'd know right away that it wasn't the real thing.
Oh, yeah. It looks like little droplets, little frozen droplets.
And it's not. Well, let's have Brian ask this question. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. My brother Dan just came home from college, and he's a physics major. And we are wondering if the nucleus from that dust particle is probably not symmetrical, how is it that the resultant snowflake usually is symmetrical?
Well, the nucleus just provides the starting point for the ice to freeze, or water to freeze. Once the process starts, then water vapor condenses on the growing snowflake, and it quickly envelops the dust particle, and then it's no longer in the picture. And then what results is just the crystal growth is symmetrical after that.
And do we have any idea why it is always symmetrical?
Well, sure. That's the water. Ice is a crystal, and the water molecules are in a regular lattice.
Mm-hmm.
And it just turns out in this case they're in a hexagonal lattice. And that's the way they hook up. Some surfaces grow more slowly than others, and that produces facets, and that produces a hexagonal shape.
Let's go to Aaron from Lakewood, New Jersey. Hi, you're on Please Explain.
Hi, thank you for having me, Brian.
I'm Leonard, but it's okay.
I'm sorry, Leonard.
What's your name again, Mike?
It's Aaron.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, I apologize.
Okay. What's your question?
It's amazing how God runs the world so perfectly, and I think that the snow works as a filter system. I haven't heard them talking about that.
Does it work as a filter system?
It can pull some impurities out of the atmosphere, and that's why sometimes where you get dust mixed in with the snow, it will come down in a color. Of course, that can happen for rain as too, but any precipitation helps to filter the impurities out of the atmosphere.
So as long as it, whenever it rains, that's why it always smells so much better after the rain stops, because the air has been cleaned?
Yeah, and the visibility, of course, will be better as well. And a lot of the pollutants, both natural and human, will be removed.
Karen from Lawrence Harbor, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I had heard when I was very young that you can tell how long it's going to snow. And, of course, we wanted it to snow a very long time when the snow, when the flakes were small and tiny. And then if they were big, it was going to be a short snow. And I was wondering if there was any truth to that.
Well, I'll handle that one. Yeah, there is in a sense, because the bigger flakes you're seeing oftentimes are those puffballs that the professor was describing. And that it gives you that indicates that the snowflake is a little damp, a little wet. So it may indicate that the thermal profile of the atmosphere is getting real close to freezing, and with just little added warmth, it can turn that, melt that snowflake and create a raindrop on its way down. Whereas the finer flakes show you that the atmosphere is much colder where the flake is formed and as it traverses the atmosphere on the way to the surface. So, yeah, when the flakes start getting larger, it's an indication that it might turn over to rain.
Okay, Karen?
Awesome. Thank you.
And John from Long Island, you're on. Please explain.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I experienced a strange phenomena. It was snowing, but the snow was almost like tiny little snowballs. They were maybe a quarter inch in diameter. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on how it was almost like popcorn falling from the sky. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on how that might have been formed.
I know that one. That's called grapple, probably, at least from what your description is. And often when the snowflake, an individual snow crystal will run into the cloud and the droplets from the cloud will stick to it and freeze. And it ends up looking like a very white little, just a bunch of little droplets stuck together.
Yeah, it was very light. It was very cool. I mean, it was just, yeah, really unique, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for calling us. My guests are Kenneth Librecht, professor and chairman of the Department of Physics at Caltech, and David A. Robinson, the New Jersey State climatologist and a professor of geography at Rutgers University. Our number here is 212-433-9692. We're talking about snow on today's Please Explain. And Greg from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. My question is, I know you guys might have touched on this earlier, but it involves how no two snowflakes are alike. And I was just wondering if there's any scientific proof to back that up or if that's just, you know, a hypothesis, because I'm just wondering how, you know, given the amount of snowfall and the amount of flakes, how it's possible to prove that.
Over millions of years.
Well, you certainly have to say it's a hypothesis, because obviously we haven't gone and measured them.
Yeah, yeah.
But one thing you can do is you can estimate how many different ways there are to make a snowflake, just like you can estimate how many different ways there are to make a fingerprint or anything like that. And in the case of a large, complex snowflake, the kind you usually think about with the branches and side branches, there are so many different ways. The number of possibilities is very easily larger than the total number of atoms in the universe.
Wow. So
you can kind of easily say that you're certainly not going to see two alike anytime soon. On the other hand, we make them in the lab, and we like to make little tiny ones where they're so small, they're almost microscopic, and they're so small and so simple that they're really just little hexagons. And in that case, you know, they look pretty much the same.
Thank you so much for your call. Craig from Manhattan. Hi, you're on Please Explain.
Thank you very much. I was curious knowing, how can the average guy see the pattern of an individual flake in nature or otherwise?
A simple magnifying glass, the kind you get for a few dollars at the drugstore, does a pretty good job.
But does the surface the flake is on matter?
Well, what you see depends on what's falling out of the sky. I mean, some of the flakes look a lot like sand. They're not really very attractive. But every once in a while, you get some really gorgeous ones.
But I guess what I'm saying is, when it lands, when it hits, and it's not moving, does it matter what the surface is that the flake has fallen on? Like would a car windshield be better than, say, concrete?
I always like the car windshield. it's a nice slope, and you can brush them away. You know, dark-colored sleeves.
Thank you very much.
Dark-colored things work best.
Thank you so much for your call. Stanley from Brooklyn, you're on. Please explain.
Thank you. I'd like to know whether the research into snowflakes can be applied by analogy to the formation of the analog of snow on other planets from substances like ammonia or methane.
Wow. I would think so. I find when you're looking at crystal growth, that there's a lot of similarities between different materials forming crystals. Every crystal has its own little foibles, but once you start to understand the basic process, then, yeah, you could apply it. And people have even talked about carbon dioxide snowflakes on Mars.
Mm. John from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a question about thunder and lightning during snowstorms. I mean, if rainstorms start out as snowstorms, why don't we hear thunder and see lightning during snowstorms?
Actually, there are cases where when you do, sometimes from very strong frontal passages during the winter, but oftentimes when you get a nor'easter on the East Coast real wrapped up, I shouldn't just say it's the providence of the East Coast, but anywhere, you can create a situation where you get that charge differential from the top to the bottom of the cloud and down to the surface, where you can have some lightning and some thunder. They generally need a lot of vertical development of the clouds, and that may not always be there during the winter season when the atmosphere is much colder. But there are cases when you get these very strong low-pressure systems wrapped up, and occasionally when you've got a frontal passage coming through, it's enough to spawn some thunder and lightning. You can also get it up in along the Great Lakes where you get lake effect storms. But you need a large gradient in temperature up through the atmosphere, and then you get those charge differentials.
Thank you so much for your call. Larry from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Real quick question. I'm a physics person. I'm a crystallographer. Deuterium oxide, which is probably heard of, it's heavy water and played an important part in the bomb. If it forms, heavy water and were to freeze, would it make the same kind of snow patterns? I don't know if you know that.
People have made snowflakes out of heavy water, and yes, they look pretty much the same as regular snowflakes.
They do look. In other words, I thought the extra neutron might affect the valence. And
it affects the freezing point. It changes it a few degrees, but other than that, not too much.
And
okay.
Tritium
probably
oxide.
The same, although I don't think anybody's made snowflakes out of tritium water.
Thank you so much for your call. David from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Yes, please. I'm wondering if there's a way to convert the number of inches of rain into the number of inches of snow. Would a heavy rainstorm, that a lot of people say, if this had been snow, it would have been 3 feet of snow. Is there a formula for that?
Good question. The general rule of thumb people have said for eons is 10 to 1, 10 inches of snow to an inch of liquid. But that can vary anywhere from 30 or 40 to 1. And with a very, very dry, soft, powdery snow falling with no wind blowing to pack the snow together, down to 4 or 5 to 1, where you get a very wet, dense snowfall. So rule of thumb, 10 to 1, but commonly 7 or 8 to 1, upwards of 15 to 1 is what you'll find in the eastern, central part of the country. As you get out into the mountainous west, your ratios tend to get higher. 15 or 20 to 1 is not uncommon.
Thanks for your call. We have Rob from Westchester on the line.
Hi, Lenny.
Hi, Rob.
Thanks for taking my call. One of your guests mentioned that the snow in Antarctica evaporates. He said it went from a solid state to a gas. I noticed on the windshield of my car, sometimes ice crystals will seem to evaporate without turning to liquid first. I don't understand that process. I thought that water, it needed to become water before it became gas.
Gentlemen?
That's not true. Ice can go directly to the gas phase.
And why would it become gas? It just breaks up into its component parts?
Usually if the vapor pressure above, if there's not very much water vapor in the air, then the water vapor will start to evaporate from the ice if it's warm enough.
We don't have much time, but a listener wants to know about hailstorms in August.
Well, that's a different process, generally. There may be some snowflakes high in the cloud, but the hail is forming as rain, moisture, water accretes around ice high in the atmosphere. Then turbulence lifts it back higher in the cloud.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you both so much, David Robinson, Kenneth Librecht. Thank you so much for participating, and please explain today talking about snow.